Transportation Committee will come to order. Today we've got a couple overviews, one from the Metropolitan Council and the other from the Port Authorities. Mr. Bell, thank you for coming to the committee, and please indulge yourself.
All right. Senator Murphy, I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee and present an overview of the transit activities in the Seven County metropolitan area. I believe you have the accompanying slides that I will be reviewing with you. The first is just the first slide you have is a broad overview of the council in general. I think all of you are aware of what the Metropolitan Council's overall responsibilities are, somewhat at a 30,000-foot level. We have community development responsibilities, and under that we have listed for our Livable Communities Grant Program, about $14 million a year. We have the largest HRA in the state of Minnesota. We provide 5,800 units of Section 8 housing. As you also know, Senator, we are engaged in land planning. The 189 municipalities will be submitting their comprehensive plans in 2008, and we plan for and fund part of the regional park system, which encompasses 5,300 acres. In our environmental services, we plan for wastewater treatment services in the Seven County area, and we also run the wastewater system, building those huge interceptor pipes and processing wastewater for 108 of the 189 communities and 8 treatment plants. More specifically, that I'll be addressing today, Mr. Chairman, is our transportation activity, and you could divide that up into, broadly speaking, two major buckets. One is metropolitan-wide transportation services, and then the services that are provided by our metro transit operations. Let's go to the next slide. When you look at our transportation functions, there are two major functions that we are involved with, Mr. Chair. The first is our planning functions. We are designated as the region's MPO, which is the Metropolitan Planning Organization. In addition to that, we our second role is the largest provider and lead agency for transit services in the Twin Cities. We provide, contract for, and coordinate metropolitan transit services in that area. Let's go to the next slide. Let me talk about the first of those, which is our planning. As I mentioned, we are the Metropolitan Planning Organization. There are four primary functions that we undertake as the MPO. The first planning is we three key reports which define transportation in the region. The first of these is called the TPP, and this sets the long-range transportation vision, and we are planning on updating that in 2008. That's the Transportation Policy Plan, and we will be doing an extensive update of that, actually, next year. The second is the TIP, and this identifies the transportation projects which will be funded in the region over the next 3 years. That's another major planning function, and that's our Transportation Improvement Program. And the third is the UPWP, the Unified Planning Work Program, which sets out the transportation studies and research that will be undertaken in the region on an annual basis. Mr. Chair, in addition to that, major transportation studies we also undertake. Many of those that we do in concert with MnDOT are corridor studies, transit studies, highway studies, et cetera. We also, for federal funding allocation, this is a local competitive solicitation for federal funds, and we are involved with studies that provide for that. Let's go to the next slide. Yeah. go to the Transportation Advisory Board. Mr. Chair, we have a Transportation Advisory Board. This is called the TAB. It has 33 members. 17 of them are locally elected officials. Membership is specified in state statute, and it has the following membership: the Commissioner of Transportation or a designee, the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency or a designee, one member of the Metropolitan Airports Commission appointed by the Commissioner, one person appointed by the Council to represent non-motorized transportation, one person appointed by the Commissioner of Transportation to represent the flight industry, six persons appointed by the Council to represent public transit, seven elected officials of cities within the metropolitan area, including one representative from each first-class city appointed by the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, and then one member from each of the seven county boards in the metropolitan area. Eight citizens are appointed by the Council for the 16 districts. So we have one person for two districts. One member of the council is appointed by the one member of the council is appointed by the council to serve as well. The council also appoints the chair along with members of the advisory body. Yes. Mr. Chair, let me now direct your attention to our transit ways. As you are aware, we have what we term Tier 1 and Tier 2 transit ways. This is a process that I indicated earlier will be updated in our 2008 Transportation Policy Plan. In our Tier 1 transit ways, we have the Central West Corridor, North Star, Cedar Avenue Busway, the 35W Busway, and Botno Boulevard. In our Tier 2 transit ways, we have the Southwest Corridor, the Rush Rock, the Rush Line, and the Red Rock Corridor. And the two existing ones are the Hiawatha Line and the I-35W Hotline, or Hotline, 394, I'm sorry. Tier 1 transit ways... the Central Corridor, we recently received FTA approval to enter preliminary engineering. That process is going to be about a two-year process and then 1 year for final design. We hopefully will secure our full funding grant agreement and begin construction with completion scheduled for 2014. The North Star Commuter Rail Line is awaiting approval of our full funding grant agreement, and we hopefully will receive that soon. The Cedar Avenue Busway is conducting station planning, expansion of park and ride capacity, and roadway improvements. I-35 Busway, and by the way, Cedar Avenue Busway, I will in a minute talk about the bonding dollars we have secured for both Cedar Avenue Busway and the 35W Busway. The 46th Street Station to be completed with the I-35W Crosstown Project, which will be underway shortly. And Botno Boulevard, we are in discussions with Hennepin County concerning with Hennepin County, who is negotiating with Burlington Northern and Santa Fe regarding right-of-way possibilities on Botno Boulevard. Our transit providers, it's, as I indicated in my opening, Mr. Chair, Metro Transit is provides the bulk of our service in the seven-county area, but there are a number of other transit providers we have as well. Metro Mobility being one. We also have contracted regular route service where we have contractors providing regular route service rather than Metro Transit in parts of the region. We have a number of community programs that provide service as well. This is not a contracted route service. It's more like dial-up service and the like, as well as having a number of public van pools. And then, of course, the suburban transit authorities, formerly known as the opt-outs, are significant partners with us in this region. This, Mr. Chair, is an overview of where some of these services are, or for Metro Transit, I'm sorry. The map that you...
Mr. Bell, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bell, can you tell me whether the suburban transit authorities, you mentioned that you contract out some routes. For a time, some of them were contracting with you to provide service. Is that been altered, or is there still some of the opt-outs that contract for the service with Metro Council?
Yeah. Senator Murphy, Senator Olson, we still have one suburban transit provider that contracts with us to provide service in their area, and that's Maple Grove.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, what I have on the overhead now is an overview of where Metro Transit, again, the major transit provider in the seven-county area, provides services. As the map indicates, you see the seven-county area. The black line that you see is what is known as the transit taxing district, and I'll talk about the transit taxing district in a minute in more detail. And then where the shaded areas where Metro Transit provides services. Metro Transit provided almost 74 million rides in 2006. That is up 6%. And we have a goal of 75 million rides this calendar year. As the overhead indicates, it provides 93% of the region's transit ridership in 827 buses. We have 27 rail cars and have 113 routes. The number of employees at Metro Transit is almost 2,600, and we are the 15th largest transit system in America, based on our ridership. A little bit more information on the customers of Metro Transit, and not just the customers, but the service that we provide. 82% of the trips are for work or school. 40% of the people who work in downtown Minneapolis use transit. I believe 20% of the people who work in downtown St. Paul use transit. This is an important fact. The third bullet, 86% of our train riders and 67% of the bus riders have a car but choose to use transit. 56% of the train riders have a household income above $50,000. Yeah. This is also an important fact because many people view transit as something only for the indigent, and that really is not the case. And we do a customer satisfaction survey that showed that about 90% of our customers are satisfied with the service. 19% of our transit riders have income in excess of $70,000, which is another, I think, important point. Metro Transit has a number of partnerships, particularly with businesses and with higher education, and I will spend a minute defining a few of those. Our Metro Pass system is probably the best known of these. Metro Pass is a deeply discounted annual transit pass purchased by employers for their employees. Metro Pass ridership increased 28% in 2006. We have 153 employers and 31 new employers were added in 2006. Most Metro Pass employers subsidize the cost of an annual transit pass for employees interested in using transit. Employees typically can purchase on a pre-tax basis their pass. In addition, employers get state and federal tax advantages. Employers pay $828 per year for the Metro Pass, and most employers ask the employee to contribute $420. So it's really a shared purchase where the employer pays about half, the employee pays close to half, and the employer gets a number of tax breaks in addition to that. And as you can see by the information I shared a minute ago, this is something that has grown fairly rapidly. In addition to our Metro Pass service, we have a program called Transit Works. These employers sell transit passes in the workplace. They pass on a 5 to 10% discount to their employees. So this is not a yearly pass, but a pass that can be sold to their employees.
UPass,
that we do with the university.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bell, on the when you that employer purchased pass, when you said that $400-some is what the employee pays, is that and that is with pre-tax dollars? So they're technically getting that for even less?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I believe that is the case, but let me. It's pre-tax dollars. Yes, it is.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it is a good deal.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I should probably mention, though, that employers get similar consideration for parking benefits. So just trying to put these on an even keel with parking benefits.
They get the same tax consideration for parking revenue, Senator Dibble?
I believe so, yeah.
I would hope your subcommittee takes care of that.
Mr. Chair, I really want to stay out of that.
Yeah, Mr. Bell, we get into this little parking ramp issue again.
Yes. I'm going to steer a mile clear of that if I can. The UPass, Mr. Chair, is something we have at the University of Minnesota that was started in the fall of 2000. At that time, we had 8,200 persons participating in the UPass program. That's a program that's even a better deal. It charges $62 per student per semester. In the fall of 2006, that number has grown from 8,200 to 18,600, a 45% increase since the inception of the program. So that's something that also we are quite proud of. We have since expanded that to other area colleges, to 13 other area colleges, with our go-to college pass that is similar to the UPass that I just spoke of.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bell, on that one, do the universities contribute, or where is there a subsidy there if they're getting that, and as you mentioned, a very discounted price? How is any of that money made up, subsidized elsewhere, or just comes out of Metro Transit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, my understanding is the colleges have an option to subsidize part of that, and some do and some don't. Is that correct? You want to expand on it? This is Brian Lamb, the administrator of our transit services.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Lamb.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Senator Fischbach, in answer to your question, what we've done with each one of the colleges is we've looked at their existing transit usage and then priced it so that we would recover at least that amount of revenue and allow them to market to get more riders so that we're not losing any revenue over what we had previously, with the understanding that then we go back on an annual basis and say, okay, where you might have started with 100 riders, but now you've expanded the program to 200, let's look at repricing this, and it's the same model that we use for our Metro Pass as well.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Lamb, in the repricing, what direction does it generally go when you reprice that a year later?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, typically that goes up, but we negotiate with each individual college based on their service availability. Some colleges that we have under our current college pass right now, if they don't have a lot of access to transit It actually has a lower per semester cost than those that are kind of in the core of the metropolitan area. But we, our history with both the UPass and other PASS programs is that the cost per unit goes up over a period of time.
And Mr. Chair, one last question, if I might. Are the colleges, there was a mention, and it wasn't real clear, if the colleges contribute. Are the colleges able to contribute and kind of buy that down? Is that how, is that, that's why it's an optional contribution from the universities?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, that's correct. And I should mention that the College PASS program is a pilot program started just this year with many metro area colleges. And some colleges, for instance, Normandale Junior College, has decided to deeper discount the price to the student by picking up some of their subsidy from their individual transportation fund. Other colleges have sold it at the Metro Transit price that we're offering the college at a growth level, if you will.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, on your screen, on the screen now is some activities that we will be involved with the Metro Transit portion of transit services in the seven-county region this year. One, the first is to restructure the Northwest Metro routes. Mr. Chair, from time to time, we go through a restructuring of our routes, trying to make sure that they are as efficient and customer-friendly as possible, and we will be going through that process. A second is to build upon an already excellent safety record we have at Metro Transit, but to even enhance that further. I often say transit works when it takes you where you want to go, when you want to go there, and you feel safe using it. And so we are going to continue to build upon the fine safety record we have. For instance, new buses will have 5 onboard digital recording cameras, up from 2 cameras today. And we are tripling the number of onboard security trips and officers. As you know, we have a transit police force, and they will be spending more time in uniform and on our various transit vehicles. The third is to promote high frequency network of service, and that is service every 15 minutes. That will be up to 14 routes. The fourth major initiative is to evaluate our next bus arrival information. So that customers really do know, they're not standing there wondering when the next bus is going to come, but they'll be able to look on a PDA and really be able to determine when it will be coming. To improve bus on-time performance from its current 88% to 91%, and the final is to fully implement our go-to smart card fare collection. This is an automated type of fare collection. Currently, we use that with our MetroPass and UPass customers. We're piloting it. We are in a pilot presently with 2,500 other customers, and we are looking forward to an entire system rollout on March 1st. So those are our 6 major activities for this current calendar year.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, one of the comments I've heard from my cities is that they feel like there's a lack of suburb-to-suburb bus routes, and I wonder if part of that has to do with one of my cities being an opt-out city, so perhaps if they didn't opt out, there might be more suburb-to-suburb, but then I know Minnetonka's not an opt-out, and they have commented on that, too. I think one of the patterns that we see in the western suburbs is that people who are living in the suburbs are then working in other suburbs. They're traveling between Minnetonka and, say, Eagan, or Minnetonka and Eden Prairie. What's your experience with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that is something that I have heard a number of times, a concern about suburban to suburban transit services. I think that you framed the question or the issue well. Some of it is a question of opt-outs. But at the end of the day, our transit system, as you well know, requires a subsidy. We're at about 30 to 32% comes from the fare back box, the rest from the taxpayer. And so when we look at or consider a route, that's a major consideration we have, is just what is the ridership. When we do our system plan update in 2008, some of those questions will be looked at anew. And as we do our sector analysis, we have a number of different sectors. And as I mentioned, the Northwest Corridor, we're going to do an analysis of that sector. And that's when those type of questions, Senator, that you have raised get addressed. But at the end of the day, we really look at what is the efficiency or the yield that we can get, or to try to minimize that that subsidy given the scarcity of dollars. And so that would be my answer to the individual that would ask that question, is that there might not just, while that's a problem for some, there might not be the volume that would justify a regular route service. The final point I would make is that some of the other services that I talked about, the contracted regular route services, some of the community program services that we have, attempt to deal with some of those issues. Maybe not as comprehensively as we would like, but they do attempt to address some of those issues.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell, if you could spend a minute either now or later just to share with the committee just a little bit, so they can gain a little bit better understanding of the opt-out provider services, what their history is, you know, how they came into being, and what their continuing, what the continuing rationale is for having opt-out transit service in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, if I could ask you if we could address that, because I
sure.
have that a little bit later where I'm
Great.
Going to go into that service and what the history of it is. So.
Wonderful. Thank you.
One of the things that, Mr. Chair, I'm most proud of is our activities, environmental activities at Metro Transit. These are things that we are very proud of, and we are working fairly hard on. And I've listed a number of them on the slide. As you can see, we are currently using ultra-low sulfur fuel. About 2 years ago, we moved over to that. We had a discussion with the PCA, and they were encouraging us to do it. Quite candidly, we thought the cost would be higher. We are the largest user of fuel in the state of Minnesota, and we are now purchasing ultra-low sulfur fuel at a comparable rate to the low sulfur fuel that we used previous to that. There will be a mandate to do that in by the federal government in 7 of 06 last year, and we were ahead of that. Biodiesel, we use 5% biodiesel since June of 06, and we are also testing 20% biodiesel. Now, we're not making a commitment to that, but that is something that we are looking at and giving consideration to.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
When you're running a 5% biodiesel blend, are you having waxing problems with your fuel, or do you have heaters, or how are you handling that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I'll ask Mr. Lamb to address that.
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have been in advance of the 2% mandate. We started testing 5% in our regular operation and found that there was no additional wear and tear or other kinds of operating concerns. Once we moved over to 2%, we started testing 10% and found that we have no additional wear and tear or detrimental effect. And as as Chair Bell indicates, right now we're testing 20%, and we're testing it particularly in the winter conditions to see whether we have any gelling or other kinds of things. Now, having said that, one thing distinguishes us perhaps from the trucking industry in that we have facilities that we park our buses in overnight, which prevent them from reaching an extended low temperature, which causes gelling. So right now we believe our operation can easily sustain a 10%, and we'll be going out for bid for a 10% mix for our whole fleet this summer, and a 20% we'll continue to test.
Follow up? Are you blending that with number one diesel or number two?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are blending it with a number one.
Mr. Bill. Chair, we also. Mr. Chair, we also, in addition to the biodiesel, have three hybrid buses at Metro Transit. It is our intention or plan to purchase 150 by 2011. As the slide indicates, this has 22% improved fuel economy, lower emissions, and they are quieter. The committee, however, should be aware that these buses are more expensive, or they're about $500,000 a copy. That's compared to about $315 million for our current buses, a difference of about $185,000. We do believe, however, that the price will come down as they get used more and as the technology improves, that cost will come down, the $500,000 cost for the hybrid buses.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chairman Bell. Is the life expectancy or the usage of the hybrid buses any different or any longer than that of your traditional bus?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, it's my understanding the life expectancy is the same.
Same.
Yes, that's correct. There's some additional benefits. Fossil fuel reduction of almost 20 gallons per bus over 20,000 gallons per bus over the 12-year life expectancy of it. So the fuel savings of 20,000 gallons is significant. Particulate matter, essentially soot, is reduced by 91%, which is significant, and nitrogen oxide is 81% better than the buses that they'll be replacing. So these hybrid buses will have not only use less fossil fuel, but be much less polluting. And again, we hope to add 150 of those to our fleet by 2011.
Here's the scene.
I'm not very good at math, so I'm just sitting here. 20,000 times 250 a gallon, that price doesn't add up to the savings of the bus. And I understand there's other considerations, with the fewer emissions and that kind of stuff. But are we being subsidized by anybody else to help buy up the cost of those more expensive hybrid buses, or is the Met Council footing that themselves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we are not being subsidized in terms of purchasing them, and your math is correct that the savings in fuel does not make up for the price differential. I would restate the point I made a minute or two ago that we do expect the price to come down. But this is something that we felt it was important to do. This is something that the governor was strongly supportive of as well. But the economics of it at present do not pay for them. That's a fair statement.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to take the opportunity to tip my hat to the Met Council. I think this is a great initiative. As a matter of fact, I was so inspired that when we had a brief Metropolitan Governance Oversight Commission hearing last December, we presented them with a certificate of commendation for this initiative. And I think, Senator Olson's question is a good one. It's right on point. We should be asking those kinds of questions. But absent creating a market for for these sorts of things, the, you know, the price would never come down. I can tell you that in my district in downtown Minneapolis, where you know, bus service is tremendous, and the buses queue up on Marquette Avenue and other places, the level of soot and just, you know, noise and, you know, the impact of buses, even though we know that buses in aggregate are an environmental benefit, you know, they take lots of cars off the road and the like, you wouldn't believe it if you're down there choking on all the fumes and the soot and listening to all the noise when they're queued up and ready to roll for rush hour. So I'm pleased with this initiative. I think it's great.
Mr. Bell.
Mr. Chair, on the screen now you'll see other effects of some of the environmental initiatives that were underway actually prior to our coming to the Met Council. You can see this chart shows a reduction of 85 tons from 1985 to 8 tons in 2011 in particulate emissions, again, essentially soot, from our roughly 900 buses. This is an impressive reduction in results from the implementation of advanced technology, essentially soot filters, diesel engines, hybrid electric technology, and fleet use of biodiesel and ultra-low sulfur fuel. The combined effect of all of those is illustrated on the chart. Also, you will see this chart shows the significant reduction of oxides of nitrogen emissions from 11,065 tons a year in 1995 to 200 tons a year in 2011. And this also results from the implementation of advanced technology diesel engines with exhaust, gas, recirculation systems, and hybrid electric technology, along with the fleet use of biodiesel and also that ultra-low sulfur fuel. This chart is also quite impressive of the reduction in two forms of emissions from 95 to what we project in 2011. Now, Mr. Chair, what you see on the slide is some information I want to provide you about the Hiawatha Light Rail Line. This has been I think by any standard, a major success. It opened in June of 2004. It's 12 miles, 17 stations, 27 cars. We have carried almost 20 million customers. Our weekday ridership is 148% above expectations. We're at about 28 1,000 riders per day. We are constructing a station to connect with North Star. There will be essentially a terminal where the Twins ballpark will be. We're adding an extension to the Hiawatha Light Rail Line in downtown Minneapolis that will connect with North Star. We have a 1,400 space ramp at 28th station in Bloomington. And we are adding an additional station that we hope to have operational at the end of 08 or the beginning of 09 at the bottom of your map, right near the Mall of America. Our fare compliance, we think, is quite good. 700,000 customers have been checked for fares. We've given out 600 citations, 1,200 warnings. The fine is $180. Our goal is to check 20% of our customers. Morning rush hour ridership continues to grow steadily on the Hiawatha line.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, you mentioned you have 27 cars on here. How many cars could you logistically put on there if the demand was – there was no end to the demand? And still make it work.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Langseth, one of the limitations we have on the Hiawatha line is that we have two car platforms and that we want to run the trains during busy periods at, I believe, 7.5-minute intervals. And so it is my understanding that we're really at the capacity with the addition of the new cars.
Mr. Bell.
The next area of our service I'd like to spend a minute talking about is our contracted route service. The map you see on the slide is the 7-county area. The gray line you see is the transit taxing district, and the lines, the blue lines inside the transit taxing district are what we call our contracted routes. Now, contracted routes are regular route service that is contracted out. This is not service that the opt-outs provide. This is service that we provide, but it is not provided by Metro Transit. About 5% of the Metropolitan Council's regular route services is contracted out to other providers. Examples are, and some of these are for-profit, some are non-profit. DARTS, Laidlaw, Senior Community Services are three examples. They provide a variety. They provide this regular route service that's contracted in a variety of bus sizes and routes. Essentially, we provide that service if it is not efficient for Metro Transit to provide that service. That's essentially when we provide the contracted regular route service. So we make that determination. But again, it's fully integrated with other aspects of our transit system.
Mr. Bell, can you run that by me again?
It's fully integrated with our other parts of our transit system. It's regular route service. We contract with for-profit or non-profit providers, and one of the determining factors is if it's cost-efficient to provide it through the contractors or through Metro Transit.
Mr. Chairman?
So we're contracting out bus service that we should be providing on a regular basis?
No, it's that oftentimes there'll be smaller vehicles where the Senator Bonoff asked the question earlier about different types of services that we make a decision that sometimes our big 40-foot buses does not make sense to provide service in that.
Mr. Bell, all we've got are big buses?
Well,
because I see an awful lot of Metro Transit vehicles running up and down the road that aren't buses.
Yeah, those are not carrying, those are service vehicles or the like.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Or Metro Mobility.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Bell mentioned Senior Community Services is one of those contracting agencies. I happen to serve on the board of that. It's the one that provides services to senior citizens, and they have made a pretty good record of efficient service. They will meet the regular bus coming out from the cities, and pick up riders and take them off in different directions where it would not be efficient to provide transportation. And so there's better service in some of these areas as a result of it. And then in off hours that's usually during rush hour, and then they are often used to transport people from nursing homes to grocery shopping, dial-a-ride type of services to seniors and others.
Senator Olson, I think Mr. Bell was talking about regular route service. And if it's regular route service, we shouldn't be contracting.
Chairman Bell included Senior Community Services in his list of contractors, and that is an example of what they are contracting out for. Now, there may be some regular route, but that is not the full picture of that contract, and I just wanted you to be aware of one instance that is working pretty well. I believe you own you first were kind of reimbursing the agency, but now I believe you are owning these smaller vehicles that are handicapped accessible and have kind of a multi-use, and I think that it seems to be working very well.
That's correct. But, Senator Murphy, even the example that Senator Olson made, some of that will be regular route. I mean, the bus will get there at 5 o'clock, and then there will be another vehicle there to pick them up, and that is and it goes on a prescribed route.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bell, do you intend on expanding any of this service, like out in Senator Olson's neck of the woods, where the demand from the senior population is starting to grow?
Mr. Chair, again, some of that gets looked at when we will update our transportation system plan in 2008. Those type of questions we will address. And we also address it when we do our sector analysis and look at the level of service that we provide. Those would be the times that would get addressed. But I think a more direct answer to your question, no, there's no plan to significantly build out that service. And right now it provides about 5% of our total service.
Okay. And all right, I'll let that one go for right now. We'll take care of that when we do the budget.
Okay, all right.
Watch it, Mr. Chairman, watch it.
Mr. Chair, the suburban transit authorities, formerly known as the opt-outs, this is an important part of our service mix. They provide services to 12 communities. They control their own transit service. Some of it's provided through contracts. Again, there's a variety of bus sizes and types. As I mentioned to Senator Olson, the Maple Grove contracts with us to provide that service. The service transit authority providers include two provider consortiums. This is an important point. As illustrated on the slide, the Minnesota Valley Transit provides services to Apple Valley, Rosemont, Eagan, Burnsville, and Savage. And the Southwest Transit Consortium provides service to Eden Prairie, Chanhassen, and Chaska. And four cities which provide transit service themselves are Maple Grove, Plymouth, Shakopee, and Prior Lake. The Suburban Transit Authority providers were designated during the 1980s at a time when the council was levying property taxes for our transit operating costs. So during that time is when the Suburban Transit Authorities came into existence. Those cities were allowed to opt out of the regional system and provide their own transit services. The cities were allowed to retain 90% of the transit property tax levied within their communities to provide their own service, and 10% of the levied amount was retained by the council to provide transit services, or regional transit. So when property tax was the major funding vehicle, they were able to opt out for a period of time. They could keep 90% of the property tax levy. 10% came to us to provide regional services. Currently, the suburban transit providers receive a proportional share of the MVEST revenue equal to the proportion of the total transit property tax they were levying in 2001, the base year, prior to the elimination of the property tax. That's a brief summation, Senator Dibble, to the question you ask of how this came about.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks. That's helpful, but I'm curious about a little bit more about the why. Why the opt-out? Was it the idea of the opt-out communities, or was it the idea of the more core communities? Is it a good idea? Does it remain a good idea? I mean, I know there's a lot of questions about the efficiency of service. It's subsidized quite heavily because of, the relative levels of ridership and the densities, et cetera. Whose idea was it, and do we still like it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, when this happened, I obviously was not here. My understanding is there was a great deal of consternation about the whole opt-out process, and that my further understanding is that there was a number of years where it was pretty difficult sledding. I would characterize, since I have been chair of the Met Council, as our having an excellent relationship with the suburban transit providers. I think we integrate our services very well. One of the things that we strive to is have a seamless system to the customer so that they really, I mean, in terms of purchasing a fare and using the system, that it's seamless. We work very closely with the suburban transit providers in terms of capital needs, construction of a park and ride facilities, purchase of rolling stock. And so while the birthing process was very difficult and awkward and I think painful, I would characterize it, since I've been at the council and even really prior to that, as it has worked out, it works very, very well now, is how I would characterize it.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Bell, I know that Plymouth does like it that way and that they're very positive about the opt-out, but I, too, wonder if it's smart for us long-term, if we're going to be able to have the most efficient transportation system across the whole seven-county metro area with these, you know, groups that are kind of acting on their own, and if that is the best way to use our resources. So have you, I mean, do you have, on a going-forward basis, do you think this is the best strategy, or do you think that there should be some discussions about pooling our resources in a different way?
Senator Murphy, Senator Bonoff, I would not propose that at this time.
Okay.
I think that I meet with suburban transit providers regularly. Brian Lamb, the general manager of Metro Transit, works with them continually. Arlene McCarthy, also a senior level of our member of our staff, works with them repeatedly. And so I think our system is fairly well integrated and really fairly efficient. And so I would hesitate, because I really don't think it's broke at this time, to recommend a change. I would characterize our relationship as very positive. That's not to say that we agree on everything all the time, but the working relationship is strong and respectful and I would say very positive.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Bonoff.
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and Chairman Bell, do you have data on some of the economics of this system in terms of the relative efficiencies of the differentiating between them as well as within the metro system as a whole? And can I assume that passengers that initiate their trips in one of those suburban communities can transfer to the metro system? And is that calculated in some way, in way in which the funding, subsidies, or whatever is handled?
Senator Murphy, Senator Olson, we do. I don't have it with me. As you would anticipate, some parts of our system are more efficient than other parts of our system. If crudely speaking, I would make two observations. One, our rail system tends to be more efficient. And when I talk about efficiency, I use one overriding measure, fare box recovery. How much are we getting from the fare box versus how much are we getting from the taxpayer?
From the?
Taxpayer.
Okay.
The subsidy. And our rail system is, I think, the most efficient. Another characterization of efficiency, frankly, is closely aligned with density. Where we run our routes, the more density there is, it's an important ingredient of transit, the more efficient it tends to be. When we get our metro mobility, a very important part of our service would probably be at the lower end. And not probably, I know it's at the lower end of the efficiency scale. Some of the dial-a-ride services and the like tend to be at the lower end of the efficiency scale. But we can get you that information, Senator. But those would be, broadly speaking, rail is efficient, very densely populated, the 5, the 16 line. These are very efficient lines where we're getting 40, 50, 60% of fare box recovery. Other places, it goes down. And when we do those sector analysis, when we analyze the sectors and analyze the routes, this is a major consideration for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only one, but
we're going to have to pick up the pace here a little bit. We've got the ports are on deck. And
Mr. Chairman?
And I see they're getting the rosin bag out. So, Senator Dave.
Mr. Chairman, I probably won't help you pick up the pace, but I'll be fast. Somebody that is myself, and I don't know why I meddled in metropolitan stuff, but I always like to do that. But so I spent three days of my life riding in a bus system. I can tell you the opt-out is by far the most efficient ever. You got to stand on those. Wherever you're coming in from all over, whether St. Paul to Minneapolis, all around, because it's just packed ridership all the time. I also am not quite as high on light rail as a lot of people know. Basically, number one, I think the numbers are totally inflated, and I say that because I don't take tickets. And if you look at how they transfer off of buses to light rail, I don't even think they have enough buses to make up the numbers. But number two, we put it in and we spent $700 million on it to help congestion. It hasn't helped congestion. It's in a corridor that light rail is wonderful if it's in a corridor where you park your car, get on, and go someplace. But from Minneapolis to the Mall of America, the people go to the Mall of America have all day just about. So if we would have put a bus thing in, but I think there's some things, and we'll wait to see the subsidy that we have to do. But I think somewhere along the line, somebody's going to have to come forward and tell us at budget time how they come to the amount of ridership. We all know the ridership. If you ever look at it, you'll find it's at night and on weekends. And if you ever look at it for Twins games, Viking games, entertainment, I dubbed it the Train to Nowhere. It actually should have been the entertainment train. I'm going to change it around because it's now we found out it doesn't help congestion and there's more people who just ride it. The majority of the people that ride it are going to entertainment things. But anyway, we'll for another day when we talk about the budget, I'll be back and we'll sit here and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But I don't buy the numbers and I never have. And somebody's going to have to really point out to me how you can dump this many buses out in the 40th Street or whatever it is to get on. And then nobody takes tickets. I went to the Veterans Hospital and asked them, even though they subsidize people to take it, the federal government actually subsidized people, as we, the state, subsidizes it, for people to ride on it. And the lady at the Veterans Hospital said, I don't know what numbers. This has been a year and a half ago, so hopefully it's picked up since then. But she said, well, we can't get a lot of people to ride it, considering all the people that park here. But it's wonderful for our parking lot on days they have ball games and such because then everybody can park out there. But anyway, we'll get into it a little bit later. But, you know, another side of the story doesn't hurt once in a while, you know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, even if it's the wrong side, right?
Well, I was just going to say, Senator Day, that was very entertaining. Thank you.
Yeah. and some of it is about as factual as, Mr. Chairman, as what you just got.
Well, Mr. Bell, it looks like you need to sharpen your pencil a little bit on the ridership numbers and bring us back a little document and, you know, firm those figures up and come back with some people who actually have counted the ridership and how that goes. And maybe you just want to have a private meeting with Senator Day because we've got a lot of things to take care of here.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I do want to say, though, clearly, with all due respect to Senator Day, I do stand by these numbers, and we will bring you information, further information to substantiate them. And, Mr. Chair, I will pick up my pace and go through some of the issues with more brevity because I want to leave some time for the budget, which I see is the most important thing. The park and rides, this is something that we're also very proud of. We can't build them fast enough. Never were the words build and they will come truer. The capacity in our park and rides has increased from 12,400 spaces in 1999 to 20,000 spaces. People using our park and rides has increased 223%. This is something that's a very, very important part of our system. Metro mobility is the next thing, Mr. Chair, that I will go through very quickly. The federal government mandates this service be provided 3/4 of a mile from a regular route during the times that that service is provided. The legislature mandates that the service be provided throughout the whole transit taxing district, again, around the black lines, which goes beyond the strict requirements of the ADA. For purposes of this committee, I think the important point is we provide more metro mobility services than the federal law requires. The average subsidy per person in our metro mobility system is $21.20. Let's move on to community programs. Community programs is another component of the overall transit picture. Dial-a-ride programs exist in areas with lower density and where regular route service is either not available or available only during peak periods. The council subsidy for 18 community-based programs ranges from $2.75 per passenger trip to $11.86 per passenger trip. The council pays about 3/5 of the cost. The community pays about 2/5 of the costs for various community programs. Ridership, as you can see on the screen, is about 500,000, and that's up 34% in 10 years. Transit financing, Mr. Chair, and this is the most important part of the presentation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Sorry to interrupt, Mr. Bell. And Mr. Chair, before we go on, I just wanted to go back, if we could, to the Tier 1 two, and Tier 2 dedication of the different transitway systems. And I was wondering how I've never heard of Botineau Boulevard transit line prior to this and how that came to be on the Tier 1 system and why perhaps a different why a Tier 2 transit line didn't go up to Tier 1 and that would go on to Tier 2.
Senator Rest.
We renamed County Road 81, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sieben, Botineau Boulevard a year ago, year and a half ago, and it so don't be taken aback by the name of the artery. Also, in which year's bonding bill?
In 2002.
2002 bonding bill is $20 million set up to explore bus rapid transit on County Road 81 as the West Broadway was built up coming out of. Out of Minneapolis, and though the improvement in County Road 81, moving north out of through now Robbinsdale, up to Crystal, et cetera, is under massive construction. So, if that gives some background on why that's there, and it's been a project in place for 5 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, and Senator Sieben. That project, when it was included in the 2002 bonding bill, was under the name of the Northwest Corridor Busway.
Great.
So it just has a new name.
Mr. Chair,
Senator.
On that same slide, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Slide number 9. As we've had this discussion on slide number 9, it's I represent Washington County, and there's a big hole in this map. Mm-hmm. I saw the park and rides, a big hole in that map. And on slide 35, looking ahead, that area is in the taxing district. So just a question as we go through all this is, why is there a big hole in terms of many of these projects? Because it appears that my constituents are paying in, but I don't see any plans up to 2030 to do anything in this area, and yet I see increasing congestion. The park and rides have been extremely successful. And if I may note, Lake Elmo has been asked to work with the Met Council. We tax them, and yet are they I'm getting service.
Well, Senator Salzman, I think a lot of that's going to change here in the next few years. I know with conversations with Mr. Bell, he knows where I'm at about the east-west metro split. I think a lot of these things were due to there were a lot of user groups on the west side that came forward and were willing to do the work, and they kind of got in front of some of us that worked on the Red Rock and a few other things, and so they just got to the table a little bit earlier. But Mr. Bell and
Senator Murphy, Senator Saltzman, a couple of points I would make. We have had discussions with Lake Elmo, many discussions with Lake Elmo on many things, but on the park and ride issue. That actually looks doubtful, but we are still considering it. They had some concerns about it. Actually, we wanted to place a park and ride there. Many of these questions, however, similar to the questions Senator Bonhoeff answered, are going to be addressed in our system plan update in 2008. That's really when we step back, take a fresh look at the lines we have, what the needs are, what the travel patterns are, and that process actually has started internally in the council. It is going to, as you would anticipate, have massive amounts of public input into it. And at that point, we will be coming up with a revised Tier 1, Tier 2 list of priorities that certainly will not make everyone happy, but really address the needs as we see them.
Thank you. I'd just like to just say that I just wanted my colleagues to see this hole in the East Metro area. It's very obvious. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I will quickly go over
Senator Dibble.
Thank you. And I thank our friends from the East Metro for pointing that out. I think it's important to see that graphically and visually and to hear from folks. But I would also just point out that, you know, we're talking about, in any case, 2020, 2030, 20, and on. And so anything that any of us will see in the East or the West Metro is going to take a really, really, really long time under the present, we're about to hear the budget, under the any present funding scenarios that we have on the table as we speak.
Mr. Bell.
Our operating budget for calendar year 2007 is $324 million. This is for our entire system, all the component parts that I talked about up to this point. As you are well aware, you see the revenue sources, the motor vehicle sales tax, state general funds, and passenger fares carry the bulk of the load for our revenues. Metro Transit and our Metro Transit Rail are about 76% of our total expenditures, Metro Mobility being 10%. The suburban providers at 7%, contract transit, and the like. It's important to note that there was a shortfall resulting from the November forecast for the motor vehicle sales tax that the governor has, I'll talk about that in a minute, but plugged in his with some of the surplus dollars in his most recent budget proposal.
And Mr. Bell, to that point, I no longer can swallow the numbers that come from finance in regards to that fund. So we're not using their numbers in that fund anymore. We're going to have Ms. Boyd work them up, and we'll use her numbers.
We have been disappointed with the poor performance of the projections for the motor vehicle sales tax.
Mr. Bell, you're being kind in saying poor performance.
Well, we've been frustrated as well. We, as you know, in part to address that, only budget 95% of that, and that hasn't worked out so well either. So hopefully
you did the best you could.
That will get corrected. Our transit capital sources, there are three state bonds, regional capital bonds, and federal funds. The federal funding sources, Title III is formula funds. Very quickly, these formula funds, we have $42 million in federal fiscal year 06, and these are really based upon service level. So if you provide so much service in a certain level, then a certain amount of federal funds follow that service level. So if you provide a great deal of service, level or great deal of transit service in a level, you'll get more of these formula dollars. Less service, less. Then there's CMAQ funding, which is really congestion mitigation and air quality. These funds are $35 million in fiscal year 08 or 09, and that is through our TAB process. You'll recall I described the TAB process earlier. And then we have discretionary funds. That's the third area. These are primarily federal earmarks. As you know, Congress is debating the whole role of earmarks. We have used them extensively for bus purchases to various special projects that we have. State bonds for transit. You can see, and I will try to be quick with this, many of the corridors, that some of the Tier 1 and Tier 2 transit corridors have received state bonding. And you can see the 06 list. These were dollars from last year. Central Corridor got 7.8, Red Rock, Robert Street, each got $500,000. The Union Depot, $3.5 million, and North Star, of course, got $60 million. And then you can see the 05, what was provided in dollars, and as Mr. Shetland mentioned a minute ago, to Senator Rest's question, the Northwest Busway, which is now Botno Boulevard, received that $20 million in 2002. We also have regional transit capital bonds. These are paid for with our property tax levy. As all of you know, the Met Council has taxing authority. The legislature authorizes the sale of these bonds. And this provides provides for buses, park and rides, garages, various repairs. We provide this for the suburban transit providers. Senator Bonner, you asked the question about the working relationship. Like, this is one of the ways where we work very closely, where we bond and then we'll build a park and ride or purchase rolling stock. For the same for Metro Mobility and ADA providers, those contracted route services, Senator Murphy, we discussed, also get supported through the regional transit capital bonds. Quickly, I wanted to mention to you the transit taxing district. The transit taxing district is the district that's outlined in black. The rest of it is the seven-county metropolitan area. This is a taxing district as part of those residents' property taxes that pays for transit, that pays for transit capital. One question or issue is that there's two questions and issues. Some of the revenue that is raised in the transit taxing district provides resources outside of the transit taxing district, point one. Point two, that many people outside of the transit taxing district use transit services inside the transit taxing district. So those are just two points, and the next slide illustrates the point. This, we do an analysis of ridership in our park and rides from outside the transit taxing district. And we do this periodically. And as you can see, well, this map is created to write down the license plates of persons using park and rides and then mapping those persons where they live. 25% of persons using the region's park and ride facilities come from outside the transit taxing district. They don't pay for the cost of providing the buses or the park and rides. And that's an illustration of just a visual illustration.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bell, in looking at the transit taxing district and the usage and stuff, is there any analysis that would show us different areas, say, to the north, my district, if we were to include part of that in the taxing district, of what actually that would mean to Metro Transit?
Well, if the transit taxing district were expanded to the entire seven-county metropolitan area, the effect would be a 4% decrease in the property tax for a $250,000 home. So the people inside, if we didn't raise the cost but kept the dollar amount the same, the people inside the transit taxing district, their property taxes for a $250,000 home would go down $4. Those outside the transit taxing district, their property taxes would go up $25.
Hmm. Okay, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the just to hit check on that, you said they're using the services, but they're improving your numbers.
Well, then you could look at it that way.
So give them a little credit.
Yeah. You could look at it that way.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of had a follow-up to that. And perhaps you could get us more information when we are dealing with the transit subcommittee, because I'd really like to know some specific analysis if we took different regions. Obviously, as you know, in my district, we have Highway 65 corridor, Highway 10 corridor. If we moved out in those directions with some transit service, expanded the envelope, you know, in terms of what does it mean, how does it affect everything, is there a plus, the minuses? Some of those things, I think we need to look at a lot more options, but we need some good numbers when we open up that discussion, I think, in the transit subcommittee.
Currently, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, currently that right now to expand for a city to come in the transit taxing district, it has to be by mutual agreement. The difficulty is there's little incentive for a municipality to say they're going to come in, because they most don't, you know, if you have 5 or 7 or 6% of your population using transit and they come into the transit taxing district. And what the problem it presents quite bluntly for us is that they would understandably demand a particular service. They'd say, we're only going to come in if you provide something. Well, they may be already getting good service because their citizens are using a park and ride that's in very close proximity. And I have some problems with that driving our decision making. And so we're in a bit of a box.
Senator Jungbauer.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Mr. Bell. Part of what's driving my thought process is the city of East Bethel, of which I'm the former mayor of, is dealing with Met Council on a regional wastewater treatment system. That regional wastewater treatment system would have a significant impact on the way the northern tier suburbs develop, obviously increase a lot of high-density development along the Highway 65 corridor. As we're looking forward to those kind of things, we also need to look at what are going to be our transportation options in the future. So although we're concerned with the near term, perhaps today, I want to make sure that we're also discussing that, you know, 4 years out, 8 years, 12 years. It's not something we can just stop at and say, well, hey, we got to serve this and this and this for today. So I just want to be thinking about that as we're going through it, at least the next 4 years that I'm here.
Senator Day, did you still have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. And please don't take this as a negative on transit, because I realize how much it costs to build highways. Do you, or it might take you some time to get this, do you have an idea? Could you tell me everybody that gets on a bus a day or gets on light rail a day, how much we're subsidizing each ride that they take each day?
And Mr. Bell, when you do that, make sure that you calculate how much we subsidize individual passengers in their passenger vehicles, so that we have an apples-to-apples discussion here, because, Senator Day, you know as well as I do, we're subsidizing them roads, too.
No, Mr. Chairman,
but we want to find out where it's at.
Mr. Chairman, I realize that, and that's why I said I didn't want them to take this as a negative against mass transit, because I'm for mass transit. But I would just like to know, because I remember about 6 years ago I asked that question, and it was a pretty astonishing number, and I'm just wondering if it's changing or going up or down. Or
Senator Murphy, Senator Day, I do not have that information right here with me. I think it is a fair question that you ask. There's huge debates about this, and as I responded to an earlier question, our system is uneven. We have less of a subsidy on our rail system than we do on our bus system. Some of our express bus services, as you mentioned, are fairly less of a subsidy because there are express routes. Some of our densely populated corridors, 16A bus, number 5 bus, less of a subsidy. And then there's always the question of externalities, you know, the cost that that aren't directly included. But it's a fair question, Senator, and I will work at getting you the numbers.
And, Mr. Bell, just a little side note here. Senator Day, I think that you know, our congestion rate is growing faster than anybody's in the, any other major metropolitan area. And when I first came to the legislature, I listened to the past chair of the Metropolitan Council tell us at one time that there were 1.8 passengers in every vehicle out on the road during rush hour. And today that's barely 1.1. So I think we've went the wrong direction in regards to transportation. That number, we should be encouraging more carpooling, and if we can't do that, we should encourage more ridership, bus ridership, rail, whatever it might be.
Mr. Chairman, we have, as you well know, we went 7 or 8 years on 394 and almost gave the ship away to people to tell them to jump into the car with somebody else, and we ended up that it was usually a spouse or one of the children riding. And we've done everything we could to do that. We also know, last night on Channel 9, they had a report on congestion. And, of course, they used the numbers 2003 compared to, I don't know, how long ago it was back. I think all of us know here that in the last 3 years, we've had the highest construction years ever in Minnesota. And 494 and 394 and 694 and even down in my area, we've did more to loosen up the congestion. And in some of the reports that are out, I hope they start using up-to-date numbers, because I think if you use up-to-date numbers, you'll find that our congestion in this last year went down for people that are driving cars, not up. But everybody keeps saying it went up.
Yeah, Senator Day, that's what MnDOT had claimed, and then we kind of looked into some of those numbers. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite done, because I will tell you, if you talk to people that drive cars, they will tell you congestion is down.
Senator Jungbauer even shook his head. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would dispute Senator Day's characterization, at least from the area that I understand well, and that's the 494 corridor. Congestion doesn't feel like it's down in the 494 corridor at all. But I would thank you earlier, maybe a little lightly, that for your stopping the use of your characterization of Hiawatha Light Rail Transit as the train to nowhere, since it terminates in my district. I'm glad that you'll be calling it something else. But actually, the question I have for Chair Bell is perhaps a little bit different twist as it relates to maybe a philosophical one. As it relates to what discussion the Metropolitan Council has there been about bikeway systems as it relates to transit? And I know bikeways are also an entertainment or a recreational activity as well, but also can be an effective transit tool. And is the Metropolitan Council where that discussion should be occurring? I know that it's not addressed in your presentation, or should it, or is it being addressed? Where is it being addressed? And isn't that an appropriate function within the council?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is. It is a part of our transportation policy plan. Congressman Oberstar is very interested in this and has secured federal dollars for this. It is a part of our transportation policy plan. Quite candidly, it isn't something that we have spent a significant amount of time on in looking at or developing, but it is a piece of our overall plan.
Mr. Bell, can we close her up?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, Senator Murphy, I will end with a very quick presentation on the transit budget, the governor's transit budget for state fiscal year 08-09. A couple of points I'll make very quickly. One is, because of the MVIS shortfall, given the November forecast, we were $7 million short, about almost $8 million short, and the governor proposes to take care of that with the surplus fund. Our budget is predicated, and this is a very important point, on the 60-40 split, And within the 40% that would go to transit, 38% would come to the metro area, 2% would come to greater Minnesota. That is a very, very important point, that the governor's budget is predicated on that notion. In addition, in the governor's budget, he is proposing to dedicate the sales tax from leased vehicles in addition to the sale of vehicles, which will cover about a $23 million shortfall that resulted from the November MVEST forecast. And when you and then $32 million for regional transit capital bond authority. I talked about our regional transit capital bonds, and then $50 million in trunk highway bonds. I think it was in 02 we got, what was it?
03 we got 36 million.
03 we got $36 million in these trunk highway bonds. This would provide $50 million. This allows us to construct park and rides and the like on trunk highways. And we would, the governor's budget proposes $60 million. Finally, this is an overview of our 07-08 budget. One point I would make, I'd draw your attention to 2 points. Under the change for federal, you see a 13% decrease. That reflects CMAQ funding. Those are federal funds that were used for Hiawatha light rail line operations. The second thing I would direct or make you aware of is that we are only budgeting 95% of MVEST because of the shortfalls that have resulted.
Well, thank you very much,
Mr.
Bell. And I'm sure that Senator Dibble, when they start getting kicked off here with his committee, is going to be in contact and have you back here. The one thing that I just want members to be aware of is that, you know, this invest money that we talked about, I'm glad the governor built that into his budget after he tried to veto it. And I'm also glad that he saw the value in Senator Bonoff's proposal on the lease tax vehicles. So we're working well with the governor here, and we're making headway, it looks like. He sees we've got a couple good ideas. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we'll be delving more deeply into the governor's budget proposal and any other ideas that members and others might have out there. But I just wanted to ask Chairman Bell, in your analysis, does this budget as proposed keep us on track with the 2020 vision plan for transit services, both including, you know, keeping on track with our desire to improve ridership and bring new facilities online, or does it put us off pace or speed us up? Or?
Mr. Bell.
Senator Murphy, Senator Dibble, it does. When we have the eye on the ball, it is really to increase ridership 50% by 2020, 100% by 2030. When I came to the Met Council, we had about 69 million rides a year. We're up to about 75 million rides a year. This will allow us to complete our Tier 1 transitways, and it will provide us adequate operational funds. Now, we're not rolling in dough, don't get me wrong, Senator Dibble, but it does allow us to complete our Tier 1 transitways. It does allow me to say with a very straight face that we can meet the 2020 goal of increasing ridership by 50% and the 2030 goal of doubling ridership from that base that I spoke of a minute ago.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Any further questions? Thanks again.
You bet.
Thanks for all your work. Yep. Appreciate it. With that, we're going to have the Port Development Assistance folks come to the table here. And while they're coming up, members, you're going to see that you're going to see a couple of familiar faces here at the table, but we lost a very familiar face in this area in Ray Skelton, and a lot of us knew Ray Skelton. He was from up in Duluth, and he was one of the people who spearheaded the Port Development Assistance Fund, and he's also, is a licensed captain, was a licensed captain.
And we lost him here this past year, and it's been a big loss to many of the people in the ports community, and it was a huge loss to the city of Duluth and Cook County and Superior and that whole area up there. I knew Ray for quite a long time. He started his career in the Port Authority in 1990, and he worked his way up and did all the schooling, worked on the boats, became a captain, certified licensed captain, and they just don't give those certifications away. He had to work long and hard, and his presence is definitely going to be missed. If nothing else, he was always good for a couple laughs. And so I spent more than one day up in Duluth with Ray dragging me from one restaurant drinking hole to another. And wherever we went, people slapped Ray on the back and had a big smile for him. And normally they were buying him the beers. A lot of fond memories with Ray. And with that, Mr. White, thanks for being here today. Did you want to kick it off? Did you lose? Did you draw the short straw? Or Mr. Lambert did?
Mr. Lambert probably drew
the straw. I think I drew the long or the short straw. Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting us to talk about port development assistance. My name is Dick Lambert. I represent the Ports and Waterways section of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And we did give you a handout. It's not going to be up on the slides on the viewing here. But I wanted to just give you a little bit of background, especially for those that are new to the committee, as far as the Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program. I wanted to give you a little bit of background of what this is all about. It's about water transportation of freight. And our second slide here on the right, water transportation. Minnesota is blessed with the Great Lakes transportation system and the Mississippi River transportation system. The Great Lakes gives us access to the Atlantic Ocean, and the Mississippi River gives Minnesota access to the Gulf of Mexico so that we are able to get our products from Minnesota to the world, and also to receive products from around the world to take advantage of low-cost waterway freight. Also, speaking for the Minnesota Department of Transportation, we do represent all modes of transportation and are encouraging them to work together. Part of our statewide freight policy that was developed here 2 years ago in our freight study, and I will read that, provide an integrated system of freight transportation in Minnesota, highway, rail, water, air cargo, and intermodal terminals that offer safe, reliable, and competitive access to statewide, national, and international markets. Page 2. In our waterway system, as I said, we have we have a Great Lakes system, which last year, or I should say in 2005, transported in and out of Minnesota ports, including the Port of Duluth Superior, over 66 million tons of product, primarily coal and also taconite. Minnesota supplies the taconite industry of the steel mills with probably 60 or 70% of the taconite material used to make steel in the country. Our Mississippi River system handled about 12 million tons of product, both coming and going. And the next two slides show what products come to Minnesota on the Great Lakes and leave Minnesota on the Great Lakes. And also the slide 7 shows the Mississippi River products that come to Minnesota and also leave Minnesota. One of the benefits of the of our waterway transportation system is that, and this is most important, it's a federally sponsored program. Minnesota does not have to invest a lot of money in maintaining a waterway transportation system on the river or on the Great Lakes. The United States Corps of Engineers maintains that system, both in the locks and dams that are provided and also dredging the system, both on the river and the Great Lakes, for the draft of the vessels that ply that particular mode. Also, the United States Coast Guard is responsible for safety on the system. They provide all the buoys and the safety mechanisms that overview the actions on the river system and on the Great Lakes. On the next slide, as far as Minnesota Port Development Assistance, as I've said previously, that's what we're here to talk about. The purpose is to maintain and improve Minnesota's River and Lake Superior public commercial ports. And we provide grants and loans to public port authorities for the improvement of their infrastructure at their facility. The port history, the legislature passed this or created this in 1991, but it was not funded. Money was not put into the program until 1996. Between 1996 and through 2006, Minnesota legislature has appropriated $17.5 million for this program. It's a combination of general funds and bonds. And to date, we have completed, we're showing here 26. We've actually completed 22 projects, and we still have four or five projects that are being processed at this time.
So, Mr.
I will
Chair?
Skip the next two slides.
Mr. Chair?
Because
Mr. Lambert?
Pardon me.
Senator Olson.
Yeah,
yes,
Mr. Chair, sir, the nature of the projects, they are not related to the navigation. They're related to the harbor handling of product that is shipped. Is that what that is used for?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that is correct. The navigation part of the system is maintained by the federal government, and it's the infrastructure, the land infrastructure, or possibly the dredging in front of the docks where we are using, where the municipal port authorities have to put up money to maintain those facilities.
Okay.
That's correct. And last year, just for review, 2006, the Minnesota legislature appropriated $3 million for Port Development Assistance Program, and all those funds have been encumbered. So at this point, we have no excess dollars in the fund. And also, if you've got any questions or any further questions you want to follow up with me, please contact me at the admin.dot. And at this point, I'd like to...
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you, you've got the Great Lakes system and the Mississippi River system. What about the Minnesota River? How does that handle?
The Minnesota River is part of the Mississippi River system.
Okay.
The Mississippi River is kind of, that's the main channel for all the rivers that flow into them from the state of Minnesota all the way to the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Just quickly.
Thank you. A number of us are also on the Energy Committee, and we're talking about renewables. Do any of the lock and dams in Minnesota have electric generation plants, you know, besides like the Ford plant? Do they have that capacity?
Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. Senator Olson, yes, they do. Hastings has got an electric generating facility that was just reestablished here a few years ago. And obviously the Ford lock and dam between Minneapolis and St. Paul has had that since the 1920s. Red Wing, you know more about Red Wing, but I don't think that one does. There are several locks and dams on the system, not just in Minnesota, but in other states that do generate power, hydropower.
Just to follow up, I thought I had seen somewhere that the Corps is looking at redoing some of these locks and dams. And who would we talk to see if that wouldn't be a feasibility to put some hydro-type plants in these?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, what you're referring to is the WERDA bill, which is trying to build seven new 1,200-foot locks on the Mississippi River system. These locks, unfortunately, are in the more congested areas further down the river between St. Louis and Lock 19 at Quincy, Illinois. Once that gets done, then we hope to be talking to the federal government again to replace more of these locks, these 600-foot-long locks, with 1,200-foot-long locks for more efficiency. And in doing that, that would probably be very appropriate for looking at additional hydropower, because several of these locks do have quite a bit of drop. And that's what you need. You need 20 or 25 feet of drop in order to develop hydropower. And that's why they had to redo Lock 1 100 years ago to have enough drop to provide us with hydropower.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I think federal government has approved in last session, I believe, the state approved the rebuilding of the hydro in Minneapolis, but it's being blocked by the Minneapolis Park Board.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we did actually have a proposal last year that did get passed for doing some tax incentives for a hydroelectric plant on the St. Anthony Falls. So
that's the one I'm talking about.
There's two. There's one on the higher that's got some trouble, and then a constituent of mine had a project that was on the lower falls.
Mr. White, are you next?
Yes, I am. Sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Myron White. I work for the Red Wing Port Authority, and my testimony today will focus on the importance of the port development assistance and the movement of cargo and commodities to global markets. The ports of Duluth, St. Paul, Red Wing, Winona, and Minneapolis, we all handle bulk commodities for transshipment into and out of the state. The efficient transportation of this cargo does not only benefit these communities, of course, but it benefits the state and the region as well. And I think Dick alluded to the federal involvement in keeping the channels and things like that operational. But these are really of regional economic benefit, not just community economic benefit. The Red Wing Port Authority has utilized the Port Development Assistance Program to make essential improvements to our port infrastructure. And specifically, we worked a couple of years ago on the relocation of our cargo handling facility, or what we call our bulkheads. We were able to relocate our bulkheads for unloading and loading barges. We dredged a new channel, resurfaced the dock area, and made some real structural improvements to the actual bulkhead facility. The bulkhead facility that we utilized had been utilized as a coal facility and really had been mothballed for probably 40 to 50 years, and we rehabbed that facility and are using that today. Probably most importantly, or one of the big things, spin-off benefits of this, is we address some hazardous traffic situations, really resulting in a safer traffic situation in the city of Red Wing. We relocated our bulk handling facility to the south end of the community of Red Wing near our primary customer, USG Interiors. Our bulkhead facility on a given season generates between 6,000 and 10,000 truck trips. At our old bulkhead facility, those trucks would pass, to give you some would pass right in front of the St. James Hotel, 6,000 to 10,000 trips between April and October, right in front of the St. James Hotel. At our new facility, that is eliminated. We are to the south of the community, and those trucks do not need to pass through the community of Red Wing. So it addressed a significant traffic safety issue in the community, and our community is much less congested, especially during the peak tourist times of that April through October area. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority has made significant improvements as a result of the Port Development Assistance Program. Now, they've done things like rehabilitated warehouse roofs, repaired several areas along their dock walls. They dredged a ship mooring facility and addressed transportation access by rehabilitating railroad tracks and road access to the port facility. The Port of Winona was able to remove a sunken barge, which was really disrupting traffic into and out of their commercial dock. They also replaced a barge mooring facility, constructed a new mooring cell, and have rehabilitated their existing commercial docks. They've also utilized port development assistance funds, and it became part of an integral part of a multimodal transportation project that Winona's been working on for several years. Now, really, just a brief outline, and St. Paul will follow. None of these projects would probably have been completed without the Port Development Assistance Program. So it's essential to the improvement of these facilities. As we look into the future, we've got a backlog of projects, and all these projects, our goal is to efficient operation and continued low-cost transshipment of Minnesota commodities via our waterways. In closing, I'd like to express my appreciation to Senator Murphy for his continued support of the Port Development Assistance Program and those of you who on the committee have supported the projects in the past. And we respectfully request your continued support in the future. And with that, I can answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Waite. Good job. Ms. Lauder.
Mr. Chairman, good afternoon, and good afternoon, committee members. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Director of Industrial Development at the St. Paul Port Authority. And I'd like to talk today during my testimony in terms of focusing on the Ports Development Assistance Program and its importance to our harbor, really its structural integrity, and including improved access to our port facilities via truck and rail. The St. Paul Port Authority has been able to accomplish a great deal through the Port Development Assistance Program. This has helped keep Minnesota competitive. We have rehabilitated warehouse roofs, repaired several areas of our dock walls, dredged a barge fleeting area, upgraded a barge mooring site, and addressed transportation access by rehabilitating railroad crossings and road access to our port facilities. Just a couple of small examples, actually big examples, but not to take too much of your time. This is really, in St. Paul's Harbor, all about aging infrastructure. We have had significant problems with our dock walls. All of our dock walls were built 60-plus years ago, as well as our warehouse roof projects that we have had to repair and replace in some cases. These are on buildings that were built 30, 40 years ago. Their useful life from the initial construction is over. So we greatly appreciate the ability to take care of these projects. As I mentioned before, it's all about structural integrity. We must keep our harbor competitive and certainly up to standards so that our tenants will continue to lease there. Very little of this work could have been done without state financial assistance. The Port Development Assistance Program provides up to 80% state financing for these projects, and then we at the local level at the Port Authorities must provide 20%. As we look to the future, all of the ports have a backlog of projects. These will allow for more efficient operations and continued low-cost transshipment of Minnesota commodities via our waterways. And as you probably know, we're taking a lot of farmers' products to the worldwide markets, and that's a big part of what we assist in doing. The members of the Minnesota Ports Association assembled a list of needed future projects in cooperation with MnDOT. Those projects have a total of approximately $6.5 million, so you can see the backlog is quite substantial. In closing, I'd like to express my appreciation to those of you on this committee who have supported the Minnesota Port Facilities by providing funding to our program. We respectfully request that you continue this support. The efficient transshipment of cargo through Minnesota ports benefits the entire state. Moving products by water is the least costly method of transporting goods in so many ways. One of our Ports Association members describes the benefit this way, and this is a quote. Waterborne commerce uses less energy, causes less environmental degradation, generates less waste disposal, is responsible for fewer accidents, and creates the least social disruption. And for good measure, it's almost always cheaper, end quote. To this summary of the benefits of waterborne commerce, I'd like to add that the waterborne commerce also prevents thousands of truckloads of commodities being moved over our highways, which would more quickly wear out our highway system, add to an already congested system, and also add to air quality problems. MnDOT has done a study on that, and it's quite compelling. Again, thank you for your support, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
When you're establishing lease rates for your tenants, do you look at capital expenditures and are covering a lot of the repair costs? Because as they were talking earlier about subsidies today, and it almost strikes me that are we subsidizing a lot of this industry by, you know, 80% state money and 20% local match? Question is, do the lease costs cover any of these capital expenditures?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, these tenants have a lot of capital costs of their own. They are buying equipment. I'll give you an example. We've just finished negotiating with PV ConAgra in our Red Rock District, which is down near Highway 61 and 494. And this company is going to be expending close to $15 million on new equipment and processing and so forth to be competitive in the marketplace. And so it would be an extra burden to charge them, we believe, for the infrastructure. This is really a basic infrastructure issue in our harbors, to have the dock walls be maintained, not to have them have holes in them, as we've seen, which impairs the whole structural integrity, because these customers have other choices in the marketplace, and we're trying to keep competitive with our competitors in the inland waterway system.
And Senator Olsen, Mr. White, maybe you can talk with the city council and find out how much of their property taxes are going to fix the roads and how much of the property taxes are going to go to the Port Authority. And I think we're going to find out that roads are heavily subsidized and ports just a little bit.
I'm fine with that, if I could do a follow-up.
Senator Olsen.
But you also had just read us a letter from evidently somebody who was using the facility talking about all the advantages and the cost savings of water. So I guess the basic question is the rent they are paying, you know, to cover the ongoing costs of having to re-roof a facility in the future, or are they getting such a good deal on the rent that there's not enough money from the rent reimbursements to cover those kind of ongoing maintenance costs?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen, great question. They pay market rents. We undertake an appraisal process to establish market value, and so we are negotiating to that market lease revenue standard. And what we do with that lease revenue is put it back into the infrastructure improvements as far as our portion of the project cost. So we believe that they are doing their thing by paying market rent and upgrading their facilities that they're responsible for, particularly equipment purchases, and in some cases they own the buildings on the land that we own. And we, in turn, are being analogous, I think, as the chairman mentioned, to the highway system, where we are keeping that infrastructure intact. Otherwise, if we couldn't supply that, and we have found sinkholes right near the dock walls, holes in the dock walls, channel dredging is necessary. We get calls, and when we're out there, we see that the depth, the draft, so to speak, for the boats is getting too dangerously close, so they can't receive product in and out. It really is, we believe, a good public portion versus private portion. And lastly, to address your issue or your question in terms of cheaper than, this is a whole economic system in terms of there are three basic modes of transport that a company can choose, and that's rail, truck, and barge. And so that was the comparison that was being made by one of my colleagues.
Senator Dibble, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually very interesting. And you know, I don't think our committee spent a whole lot of time really delving into waterborne commerce and our water ports. I think we talk a lot about our air ports. but I'd like to spend more time on water ports. It's more enjoyable. And I agree. It's a you know, for a whole lot of good reasons, it's an important sector of our transportation system to support. It makes a lot of sense. It might be helpful to Senator Olsen's question, you know, to understand, you know, kind of what the typical mode is, you know, in comparison to other states and their ports and, you know, the level of revenue that comes from user fees and leases and the like and the amount that comes directly through, you know, other more public forms of support, just as a point of comparison and information so that we understand how this public important public service is provided. Then I just, Mr. Chair, had a couple of questions. One is, you know, we talked about the environmental advantages of waterborne commerce. That's a new term for me, by the way. Waterborne commerce, and I agree completely, and it's very intuitive. It's easier to get a whole bunch of stuff around on a big barge and on container ships and the like. But one nagging area of concern is this issue of invasive exotic species that are introduced into the Great Lakes through ballast water exchange. And so I'm wondering, you know, we're dealing with that a little bit in the Environment Committee, but, you know, are the port authorities grappling with that issue? Are they trying to push the industry to do better and faster or not? It's a huge environmental problem that's brought to us, you know, by this sector, and it's going to have a it already is having, you know, I mean, we're well past the point of prevention. It's having a tremendous impact on our ecosystem and other sectors of our economy. Then the second question, if I can get to it, is this business of the locks, you know, doubling the size of the locks down the Mississippi. A lot of controversy. GOA said the numbers were cooked, blah, blah, blah. Where are we on that whole subject? So, two questions.
Mr. Lambert.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dibble, Senator Dibble, excuse me, in relation to the first question on exotic species on the Great Lakes, the Port Authority of Duluth has been involved in this study and trying to find solutions ever since I can remember. I've been working with the Department of Transportation for 13 years now, and they were working on this issue before that. The problem is volume. And these ships in their ballast water, they take on millions of gallons of ballast water each time they come and go. And depending on where they take on that ballast water is the problem of picking it up in European ports or some other ports and bringing these exotic species over here. And a lot of them die en route. A lot of them get into our Great Lakes system and will die because they're not used to it, and some of them do thrive. So it's been a question. And the states are working on this, also the federal government, the U.S. Corps of Engineers, is spending a lot of time and effort trying to find solutions. And it's a solution to attack the volume of water that gets into these ballast water tanks. And it's not a simple solution, but the industry is working with the ports, and the ports are working with the federal government, and we will find a solution for this. It's unfortunate that the invasive species have gotten so far and have corrupted the Great Lakes as much as they have without finding a solution, but that's just the way it's gone. They have several examples in the Great Lakes where the lamprey was an exotic species that got in, and they've got that under control in Lake Erie now. But it's a lot of the state agencies working with the feds to find solutions that are workable, that don't cost an arm and a leg, or that does not put the industry out of business.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble,
it's fine to talk about the industry and its expense, but the public is bearing a huge expense, both in the impact on other industries, very important industry, the tourism industry in particular, and also in the form of trying to control these exotics, which is a myth. I mean, once they get in, they're here. I mean, we're never, ever, ever going to get rid of them, and they're going to destroy, if they haven't already, the ecosystem of our Great Lakes and the inland waters, and we see the Asian carp, of course, moving up the rivers. So, and I think the key phrase you used is, been working on this for as long as I can remember. Time is up, you know, and the public's patience and the legislature's patience is completely worn out. So, to the extent that you can work with your industry partners to say the gig's up, we got to take care of this today, I'd be very appreciative. And on this issue of the locks, are we anywhere on that?
Mr.
Lambert,
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dibble, Senator Dibble, in regard to the locks, I referred to the WERDA bill, which is the Water Resources Development Act. That in that act, which is now before a conference committee, and hopefully it didn't get settled in 2006 before they shut down. Hopefully this will be coming before Congressman Oberstar's committee, and hopefully that will get passed. They're optimistic that it will get passed early this year. And in that is the funding for the federal government and the users of the system to equally share in the cost of building seven new locks, five on the Mississippi River and two on the Illinois River. And hopefully that will get started. It's still, even though it does get approved and we start appropriating the dollars, it's still years away from fruition. But that's where it stands right now. We're hopeful that this will be addressed and will get passed early in 2007. But, again, that's up to the Congress.
Well, Ms. Chair, has this issue of, you know, the concerns that the GAO had with the Army Corps of Engineers not using valid financial numbers to justify the expansion of these locks, has that been addressed? Are people satisfied with that debate now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, that has been a big controversy, and I guess I don't want to get too involved in it. This was a red flag a few years ago by one of the employees in the Corps of Engineers, who has since left the Corps of Engineers. I think they are getting beyond that now, and I think they're realizing that the Corps is restricted in what they can determine is cost-benefit, and they're not allowed to take in much of the cost-benefit of the industry, of the savings in the industry, and I think they're slowly coming around. They're asking for counsel. I sit on one of their economic committees, and we do discuss this about three, four times a year, and hopefully they will be able to show more of the benefits in order to get their cost-benefit to a point where it will sell itself better to the Congress so that they will accept the program.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Once again, I, for one, appreciate all the work that you folks do. And, Mr. Lambert, I hope your shoulder gets better because we need you at 100%.
Thank you.
Yeah. Committee members, the white budget books that are in front of you, if you could leave them here, that would be great. If somebody wants copies to take home or whatever, let us know, and we'll get that for you. But these are kind of the books that we should leave here so that we don't have to chase all over heck and back to find them. So with that, the committee is adjourned.
I didn't.